Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. We've got a ton of stuff to tell you about today. Emily McCord has this week's Politics Ohio. We'll continue our tribute to Poetry Month. Today we'll hear from Bellbrook resident poet Barbara Astor. Nikki Dakota talks with Rev Cool, don't miss that. And Juliet Fromholt takes us to Dayton's historic South Park neighborhood. But up first, my conversation with Jane A. Black. She's the executive director of the Dayton Visual Arts Center. Their annual silent auction is coming up, so we'll talk about that. But first, a little bit about the center.
The Dayton Visual Arts Center has been around for almost 20 years. Our two-decade anniversary is on July 1st, and we are essentially a service organization to professional and emerging visual artists, and also a resource for the public who is interested in contemporary art, what's going on here and now in the visual arts world. We have a really wonderful, committed following who we love, but we're always looking for more people. I think a lot of people struggle with how to find something that is original and really speaks to them. And because our organization is community-based and we have almost 400 artist members, we have something for everybody. And we're always so pleased when we can put together an artist and an art lover and they connect and find the joy and the beauty that visual art can bring to your life.
And of course, organizations like yours are imperative for the artist.
I think that's the most important thing we do is we offer artists kind of a lot of different strands. We offer them an audience, which is really important. They need people to look at their work. We offer them a community. Artists need each other. They need to talk about what they do. That's what they love. That's what we love. And then also opportunity to really celebrate the community through what we make. So to make those connections and have events and programs and workshops, those are the things we love to do. And of course, the exhibition, showing the work is very important.
I was going to ask, how do you develop that sense of community between the artists? You have events. We're going to talk about one here in a moment. But
a biggie.
Yeah. And how else do you do that?
Well, we do a series of parties called Artist Palettes that are in people's studios and homes, and that gives kind of an intimate view into how art can intersect with your life at home. We do workshops where we'll bring an artist in to talk about a particular subject, or one of the staff members will talk about kind of the practice of being an artist. How do you develop a mailing list? How do you do an artist statement? How do you tell the difference of whether a gallery is a good gallery for you or not? How do you approach them? Things like that. Professional development. And then we do public things. You know, a lot of what we're interested in is what are the needs that are out there in the community? Where is a place that needs art? Where is a place that needs artists to come in and work with the population there? And we try to put together the right people, somebody who's making the right object or somebody who has the right program, and we put them together and then everybody's served well.
And you do have one event coming up. It's the, I believe, 18th annual art auction.
It is.
And it's at Sinclair College in the Ponet Center. Let's talk about that event.
It's April 29th. This is our big event. We have been doing this for a long time, really before there were other auctions in the area. And we have more than 100 pieces of art, all donated by the artist. And because we are so artist-focused and we do so much to get the work out ahead of time and connect the artist with the collectors, we get amazing works of art. And the best thing to do is really two things. One is to come into the gallery before April 27th, Wednesday, this coming week, Tuesday and Wednesday, 11 to 6. We have about half the art installed in the gallery, so you can really see it hung at the right level and lit in the correct way, and the work is beautiful. Also, you can go on the website, and you can see every piece of art that's going to be in the auction. The minimum bids are there. The artist names are there. The media and size. Always look at the size. People are fooled on the website. They'll come and think it's a big painting and it's a little one. But the thing is, you want to get your bidding strategy together. And you want to figure out what it is that you're really interested in. Maybe measure your walls. And then come to the party. We will do sealed bids. If you can't come, just call the office. We'll set you up. But really, it's such a great event. It's very lively. The artists come. You'll have an opportunity to meet people whose work you're looking at, other collectors who are interested. I've made a lot of friends at the auction because we bid against each other every year. And, you know, some years I'll say, hey, you got it last year. I want it this year. It's just, it's a lot of fun. We have a band. We have good food. We really enjoy ourselves and the art and the people around us. And everybody's welcome. It's one of those atmospheres where you don't feel as if, oh, I didn't come with someone or I don't know enough people here. You'll make friends.
Now, you're executive director of the Dayton Visual Arts Center. Who are some of the people you're working with that are helping to make things happen?
Well, we have wonderful auction chairs, Fred Niles and Ashley Krogel. We have a large committee of people, and of course, my board of trustees all pitch in. The staff members, Janelle and Patrick, couldn't do it without them. Beth DeVilbiss, who's our coordinator this year. Additionally, we have more than 30 sponsors. We have a presenting sponsor for the first time, Joseph Airport Toyota, which we're very happy about. DATV, I have to give them kudos. They're stepping in to do this thing where we can have the auction in a separate room where it's nice and quiet and people can hear what's going on, but we're going to be able to do a live feed out into the Great Hall. So everybody who's still out there bidding in the silent auction can see what's going on in the live. So that's really nice. We have the live auctions sponsored by Dayton Power and Light for the fifth year in a row. And then we have section sponsors, the University of Dayton and Sinclair Community College, both are section sponsors, as well as Heidelberg Distributing Company. They, because they are so generous to us, allow us to have complimentary champagne for people when they come in the door too, which is also just a really nice touch, very festive.
It is coming up on April 29th.
Correct.
And where can we get more information?
Go to our website, DaytonVisualArts.org, and you'll see it's Friday, April 29th, starts at 6:30, ends around 10:30. The live auction is at 8, and it's at the Great Hall, the Ponet Center in at Sinclair Community College, and it's free parking down underneath the hall.
Thanks for joining us.
Jerry, thank you so much.
Jane A. Black with the Dayton Visual Arts Center. The preview exhibit and advance reservations can be purchased by phone or online. They're available only through Wednesday, the 27th at 6 p.m. It's worth mentioning that all the proceeds from this auction go to make sure the center stays free and open to the public. This is WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Next Saturday, April 30th, Dayton's historic South Park neighborhood will host its spring home tour. WYSO's Juliet Fromholt spoke with Amy Lee and Betsy Wilson from South Park. They began by discussing the history of the neighborhood.
Well, how the neighborhood got started was that it was actually a community where a lot of the workers for NCR lived back around the turn of the century. And it was really interesting because John Patterson of NCR thought it would be a really great idea if company executives were living pretty close to company workers and next door to them, company accountants and stuff like that. And the idea was that it would be very egalitarian and democratic. And actually, we see that even again today. I mean, we've had the same twists and turns that I think a lot of, you know, American cities have had over the intervening century. But especially in like the last 20 years or so, I would say, maybe a bit longer, there's really been kind of a renewal of that where we again have a really great mix in our neighborhood. We have people from all different socioeconomic groups, all different religions, all different professions. In South Park, we have everybody from artists to engineers to professors to gardeners to retirees, all kinds of things. It just, you know, there's a really amazing mix. There's also an amazing mix of like the kinds of families who live here. I mean, we have people who are just starting their families. We have people who have established families. And then people who are also have had all those things and are now kind of downsizing and living in smaller cottages. It's really amazing that you could actually live your entire life in this neighborhood. I mean, you could be born here. You could get a starter college when you, or a starter cottage when you were working for yourself. When you decided to get married and have kids, you could buy a slightly bigger house. And when you retired, you could get a smaller cottage to live in and age in place. That's not something I think you see hardly in very many neighborhoods anymore, and it really, really makes South Park special.
I researched the history of houses, and one of the fascinating things about South Park is that what Amy was saying about different socioeconomic groups is reflected in the architecture. So it's very unusual here. You walk down the street, and you'll see a tiny shotgun, which is just a narrow one-story cottage, next to a three-story Queen Anne with a lot of gingerbread. And so you can see the physical aspects of what she was describing.
And as far as the physical aspects of this neighborhood, when you drive around the neighborhood, you see some houses that are done up and very colorful and have a lot of character and personality. And you've also got a lot of houses that are being rehabbed. Tell me a little bit about that effort that's been happening.
Renovations in the neighborhood have really taken off, especially in the past 20 years or so. We definitely had two major landmarks in that. There were 2001, there was a rehab-a-rama, and then another in 2007. And I think between them, about over a dozen houses have been renovated completely, and that's been really amazing. But we also have a lot of other people who live and work in the neighborhood also buying houses in addition to the ones they live in to rent out to people, because people realize the more of an impact you can make if you also decide to buy some property, fix it up, it makes the whole neighborhood look better, we get more people in here, and it's additional income for you. So I think that there are a lot of people who are in South Park who are definitely trying to become rehabbers. We definitely have attracted a lot of them, and we have some outside ones as well. So we just have a really nice mix. I think that people recognize that when you achieve that kind of critical mass of all people working to improve the neighborhood, that your efforts can really seem doubled.
And as far as the houses themselves, have you found any interesting stories within these neighborhoods? Have there been any notable people in Dayton history that have lived in this neighborhood?
One of the things in a general sense of the neighborhood that I found was that we had a number of different ethnic groups. Like most of Dayton in the 19th century, South Park was very German. But then there was also a small enclave of Russian Jewish immigrants who were centered around their synagogue on Wyoming. And they brought a very unique character to the neighborhood. Most of them were fruit sellers. They had horse and wagon that they would go around and sell fruit. Also, among the German families, they tended to keep the community very close by children building houses close to their parent. For example, in our house, the house immediately behind it was built by the father for his daughter, probably around the time that she got married. And so the whole extended family was essentially on one house lot. And that was one of the aspects that made it such a close community at that time.
And is that reflected in the styles of the houses at all, that sort of close-knit, you know, having a whole family in one block? Does that make the actual style of the architecture similar, or did it follow more of the trend of the particular generation for whom the house was built?
I think it tended to follow the trends more. There was a family on James Street, and there were three sons who built houses within a block. And while the parents' house was more of a vertical Italian 1880s house, the sons' houses had many more elaborate decorations that were typical of the 1890s, early 20th century.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the home tour itself. Amy, why don't we start out, just give us an overview of what's going to be happening that day.
On Saturday, April 30th, from 1 to 6 p.m., we are having a self-guided tour of 8 homes in the South Park neighborhood. We're kind of focusing on the west side of South Park this year, and so we have 4 houses on Alberta Street and then another 4 houses on Park. The ones on Park tend to be these really beautifully restored Victorians that have some surprisingly fun modern touches inside, but the outsides and much of the insides have really been beautifully renovated to maintain that historic character. And then on Alberta, we see more of the Queen Anne frame houses. So you'll see a lot of the decorative brick and gable work and wrought iron fences. One of them has a two-story carriage house, so we have a lot of extra architectural details that I think people will really appreciate being able to see. But we also will have a South Park information booth and a place where people can get some lemonade to kind of refresh themselves as they go around. Another thing we're doing is we're having a digital scavenger hunt. This sounds odd for a historic home tour, but we're trying to blend the past and the future. So as people come along, they can use their smartphones if they'd like to look for codes that will be placed strategically along the tour, and that can help people find out more about the neighborhood and why we all love living here so much. And when you participate in the scavenger hunt, you're also signed up to win an iPad 2. So we're really trying to show the mix of history and the future that we're trying to blend here. And I think that, again, I mean, you see that in the fact that we have these beautiful old homes, but we a lot of times have really young families and new people moving in all the time who are a lot of times working in tech-based businesses at Tech Town or in the aerospace hub and everything. So it's just another thing that shows the blending of influences that make South Park what it is.
With these young families coming in, do you find that they're really interested in finding out the history of their homes?
Many people are. it's such a unique thing to live in a home which has had so much history. And I find that people, especially when they've learned more about the history of their home, often think of it not so much as their own home, but as a home that they're a steward of. That my husband and I feel that way about our house, that we have the privilege of living in this house where families have lived before, and we're doing our best to pass it on to the future.
Well, let's talk about this this idea of blending sort of the modern and the historic. You're doing that in the home tour itself, but do you have any examples of either the triumphs or the challenges of taking, you know, all the trappings of a modern life and putting them into, you know, a historic home in a historic neighborhood?
It's actually surprisingly easy in many ways. If you get a contractor who can come and put a new kitchen in or a new bathroom, you can have the most modern kitchen in the world and within this lovely historic structure. And they really do blend amazingly well. And it's fun to see going back to the home tour for a minute, it's fun to see how people have done the insides of their homes, because some of the are fixed up very Victorian, very traditional, with the upholstery, the wallpaper, all of the decor of a Victorian house. And others are quite modern, very eclectic and spare, and yet it all seems to fit together.
That was Juliette Fromholt speaking with Amy Lee and Betsy Wilson about the Spring Home Tour happening in Dayton's historic South Park neighborhood next Saturday, April 30th. More information on the tour is available at historicsouthpark.org. Up next, Sarah Buckingham to tell us about this week's documentary.
Tonight on the Sunday Documentary Hour, the first installment of a new two-part documentary. Passengers explores the many challenges facing public transit and the consequences for climate change. Our love affair with the car has dramatically shaped the American landscape. But along with personal mobility, we endure lengthy stop-and-go commutes, urban sprawl, smog and greenhouse emissions, and the drain on our wallets as we fill and refill our gas tanks. Learn the emerging role public transportation may play in alleviating these problems now and in the future on Passengers. This documentary features many American voices: motorists filling up near a freeway in California, commuters waiting on a light rail platform in Charlotte, students in Chicago who use their handhelds to monitor when the bus is coming, and an Arlington, Virginia commuter who took a city-sponsored challenge to find out if he could get around for a month without a car. Passengers was produced by David Freudberg in association with WGBH Boston. Hear part one of Passengers tonight, right here on WYSO.
Tune in for Passengers tonight at 6. The Promised Land with host Majora Carter will continue in the 11 o'clock hour. Sarah will be back next week to give us a sneak peek at the upcoming season of the Moth Radio Hour. Earlier this month, WYSO's Conrad Balliot and some local poets had a poetry reading at the Dayton Public Library. Today, we'll hear from Barbara Astor. She's a poet and pen and ink artist from Bellbrook.
This poem is called Visitor. We had come to see what the commotion was as we collected on the porch to look out the screen door where our dog stood barking. In a strange way, it seemed almost human, how it stretched out on the sidewalk, unassuming, as it lowered its head into the water bowl. Such a long drink of water. I wondered how the wetness reached bottom, how it dragged itself around as it did in so much dirt, and how the snakes want for a good rain, even then, could ever satiate him. And my second poem, which comes from a different collection, I selected to read because I just couldn't help myself. It's called Hail to Dorothy Parker. Knights in rusted armor, no benevolent kings, moon-eyed maiden fairy tales, grim, indigent dreams, slippers small, ill-fitting, a vat could hold my own. Be gone, corrosive prince toads. I'll sit and rust alone. Thank you.
poet Barbara Astor. This October, Finishing Line Press will publish a chapbook penned by Astor titled 30 Years Past. You're listening to WISO Weekend on WYSO.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Emily McCord. Today, I'm speaking with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
This week, you reported on how Democrats are upset with the governor's office because they say it's withholding information on cuts in funding to local school districts. The governor says it's available. So what's the story here?
Well, it is available, and you can find a lot of the information that the Democrats want. The problem is that it's not available in one concise source like they want it, the format that they want it. So they want spreadsheets that show totals of where the money's been, where it's going, how much everyone's getting, the different school districts, that sort of thing. And when you start looking at the budget, you realize that where schools are concerned, there are a lot of different variables. The governor has made it so that the phase out is shorter for those school districts that got kilowatt hours taxes. You've also got this loss of federal stimulus dollars. It's yet another effect. You've got overall foundation funding formula that affects how much a school district gets. And there are a bunch of other things. So if you go through and find every single variable and put it together, you theoretically, you can find that form that they're looking for. It's very complicated to do that. So even a lot of journalists have had problems trying to get the information that the Democrats are seeking in the format that they are seeking it.
So is that the responsibility of the governor's office to make this information the way that the Democrats want it?
Well, it's the responsibility of the governor's office to make the information available. There's no law that says that it needs to be furnished in one format over another. But, you know, the Democrats are saying, hey, we don't have the information we need. It's not in a way that we can understand it or we could put it together. And so, therefore, we can't vote on something that we don't know about, you know, we don't have the information about. So it would behoove the governor's office to try to work with them and see if they can come with up to some agreement so that the Democrats can get the information they want, because otherwise, I mean, how are they going to vote on the budget? That's another question that's raised there. So the answer is, in short, no, it's not the governor's office responsibility to do that. But if the Democrats are going to vote on it, they need to get the information somehow.
And what is the governor saying about all this?
Well, the governor's spokesman is telling me that they have given the Democrats the information that they've requested, at least the information that they have available. And that's the key. What information is available? What format is that information in? And the way that that's worked, they have given them the information. But, you know, the Democrats are very upset because they're saying this is not helpful. This is not, you know, they want what Innovation Ohio, for example, has come out with their tables of what school districts are going to get and where the cuts are and those sorts of things. That's the kind of information that the Democrats would like to have from the governor's office or from a state agency, and they're not getting that.
Kasich has come out saying that local school districts may be adding levies to make up for budget cuts, and he's saying that's not necessary. How are advocates for local schools responding to that?
I asked the governor about that. I said, you know, is he asking people to vote no? And he says, no, I never tell anyone to vote against a levy. But he says, what I'm telling people is that we have given these school districts a lot of tools to be able to deal with their costs. When he says that, what he means is we've given them Senate Bill 5, where they, you know, can get more money out of employees for health insurance and get more leverage in negotiations, that the governor has released some regulations so that school districts can actually cost share on some things, busing, for example, if they wanted to do that. Some of the other things that they can do to save money, you know, they can actually go in and reduce or consolidate services. And so the governor's saying, you know what, we're giving you a bunch of tools here. If you just use them, you shouldn't need a tax increase. But what the school districts are saying is some of them say they need a tax increase as well before this ever came down the pike. But now they're saying that they're getting cut so much that they, even if, and some of them say, you know, we are sharing services, we are doing a lot of this, these things that you're telling us to do, Governor, but we're still not making up the difference. So it depends on who you're talking to as to whether there's a problem here.
I've been speaking with Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
And coming up next on WISO Weekend, WISO Music Director Nikki Dakota and this week's Volunteer Spotlight.
Radio Free Europe, going back to REM's first full-length record, although we have a guest in the studio who's going to tell us that that wasn't the first place you could get that. On that note, it is my great, great pleasure to welcome longtime host of the Around the Fringe program on a Friday night. He is, does anyone know your real name? Or you're just Rev Cool?
I'm not sure.
You were telling me that you played the tune we just heard, Radio Free Europe, which is from REM's first release on IRS, but I guess it really came out a little bit earlier.
Well, yeah, because I think I started in 1982, so it had to be around that period, and might have been 81 or so, but it was on a small label out of Athens called Hiptone Records, and I don't know if Hiptone did anything. I think they might put out five little 45s of local Athens, Georgia artists. And actually, I got the 45 from Tom Carson, who at that time was the music editor at the Village Voice in New York, of course. And I happened to be in New York talking with Tom, went to his apartment, and he was playing some music. And he said, "Oh, you got to hear these guys, REM." And he said, "Here, have a copy." And I brought it home and played it.
Wow. So yeah. So you were always drawn to music, always all about music.
Yeah.
And I would like to know, that's just wonderful. You find yourself in the apartment of the writer for the Village Voice by 1982. How does that happen to a boy from Dayton?
Just curiosity, I guess, and traveling around. Although, you know, I'm known a little bit in town for the radio show, but I was doing musical oriented stuff before I was on WISO.
Were bringing shows to town.
Right, bringing shows
to
town.
Had your own record label.
Right, had a record label. Was doing like some fanzine stuff. Was actually, I forgot about that. I did write a couple of things for the Village Voice. I saw a new editor. Did some things for New York Rocker magazine, the Seattle Rocket, and a few other, you know, weeklies that were out there at the time. They were interested. They were just starting to discover some of the new music. I brought it to REM mainly because I played it on the first show I did. I remember playing that along with Bob Marley, along with Fela Kunti. And it was sort of an unusual type of radio show even for Antioch and for WYSO at that time. I think most of the shows on WYSO at that time were specialty music shows. Like you'd have a guy that was totally into the blues, totally into swing music, totally into a certain style of jazz,
in
not
each
just
case,
jazz.
Just one genre.
Right. So when I started doing the show, it was a little bit different than the norm. And it's been here for a while. So that's must have done something right.
So you started in 1982.
Right.
Can you tell me, do you remember what sounds were coming out of the radio the first time you were aware that you were listening to WYSO?
When I first listened to WYSO, it had very little power. I was in East Dayton, and I was still living at my parents' house. And on occasion, we could pick up this sort of wavy band of music.
If all the atmospheric conditions were just right.
Yeah, and that's when I just would hear, like, it was in the 60s, so you hear the typical 60s psychedelic stuff. And I thought, this is like some underground radio station from Cuba or something broadcasting.
Bouncing off the stratosphere and hitting us right in Dayton.
Right. So that's my first experience with WYS. But later on, they got a little bit more power and you could pick it up in Dayton. I actually started, volunteering for fundraisers and other type, you know, sitting at booths and that type of thing.
Nice.
For any number of years before I actually had a show.
Do you remember what it was that sort of made you realize, you know, that I want to do that?
Oh, do the show thing?
Yeah.
I was just listening and seeing some of the people I admired out the station. Mm-hmm. Thinking like Uncle Art Snyder. Art Snyder was one of my favorite shows. He had a blues show on. It was really, really listened to well.
Shaking Dave mentions him, yeah.
Yeah, and people like that just inspired me and came up with a proposal for a show, which is not too different what I'm doing today. So,
do you remember who trained you? Was it Art?
No, it's actually I heard Cindy Funk mention this fellow, Larry Blood. Larry Blood did. Yeah, we had to actually take a test for the license back in those days. And when I first approached the station, the station manager at that time, whose name I won't mention, I'll just give his initials, which were Mark Miracle. He told me that over his dead body would I ever have a show out here. So,
really?
But last time I checked, Mark is still alive.
Let's just give a big ha ha ha. Right.
Well, we get along. We get along now. It's just like at that time it was.
I probably would have given you a second. Yeah. I've given you the hairy eyeball maybe back in the day. Although I'm not sure. I'll tell you what, though. I give you an eager ear every Friday night. It's the Rev Cool who has been doing Around the Fringe here for a nice, beautiful, amazing amount of time. I think long enough that we can officially call you a part of the airscape.
Yeah, I started when I was minus 1 year old.
Rev Cool, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you so much, Nikki. It's been a pleasure and fun.
You can find him on Facebook. You can go to his website at RevCool at RevCool.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for this week's edition of Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield. If you missed any part of today's program, you can listen online at wyso.org. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.